Natural Resources for Tuesday, April 3rd, 2007. Open a public hearing on House Bill 5024, the Department of Forestry. And Mr. Brown, go ahead and start whenever you'd like.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. For the record again, I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry. Members of the committee, good morning to you. We're going to pick up when finished on the state forest program. Representative Burley had a few questions that we're going to wanted to finish off with, and then we'll go into our urban forestry program. If we get finished with that before 9:55, right, then we'll move on to the private lands program. Our urban forester is here today, and he did remind me that this week is Arbor Week, which I think means that you're supposed to treat us really well all week long. So, I think that's what that means. Anything doing with trees and forests, you're supposed
well,
to
that means that ends on. That ends Saturday.
Well, the spirit could last all week.
It takes time to grow a tree.
And I'll turn it over to Jim Paul, our chief of state forests.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. I'm Jim Paul, again, for the record, Assistant State Forester for the Forest Management Division. And I guess I'll move this mic over here. Representative Burley had a question yesterday. He asked a question you wanted to delve into regarding our how we approach the Endangered Species Act on state forests. So I guess I'll let you clarify that question. Or
Chair, if I may, on page 3-5, under KPM 7, it says item number 5, there are factors affecting the results for this target, 14% variance. Resulted from three things, the first of which is the federal T&E species issue. And I was curious how that affects state forest management, and in particular, under the Endangered Species Act, the state has the obligation to avoid take, not recover the species. So I'm curious how that affects management of state forest lands.
Sure, be glad to answer that, Representative Burley. In the context of that performance measure, what that's referring to is the variance and the shift that we saw between 05 and 06, and that was one factor that led to a reduction or meaning less, not quite close to the target in 05 compared to 06, where what can occur in terms of our annual operation plans is that we will typically have planned sales, a set of planned sales that are designed to meet our harvest objectives. We also have a set of alternate sales that we have sort of in the wings that are all prepped and ready to go, that we've gone through all the same procedures and planning process that we do for our planned sales. But we try to make sure we have enough of those that in the event that one of our planned sales ends up becoming encumbered, if through a survey we discover a T&E species in close enough proximity to that sale that we hadn't seen in a previous survey, that may delay that sale. It wouldn't necessarily result in that sale not ever occurring, but it may mean we need to do another year or two or three of surveys before we can clear that sale to go. In the event that that occurs, we will go to our alternate sales. And again, as I said, we try to have enough of those alternate sales in the wings that we can still meet our harvest objectives. Occasionally, we aren't able to, but depending on sort of the next year and the available units we have for planned sales, we can sometimes make that up and meet or sometimes exceed our harvest objectives in subsequent years.
Representative, any additional questions? Thank you very much, and I guess we'll move on to urban forestry.
Okay. The other part of my position, besides oversight of the forest management state forest program, is the also overseeing our urban and community forestry program for the department. And just to give you just a brief background on this program, we've had this program for about 15 years. It dates back to 1992. when the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2913 that directed the department to provide technical assistance to Oregon cities and community organizations and to do things such as help them plant, manage, and care for their urban forests. This program has historically been funded primarily by federal funds through the U.S. Forest Service. We maintain a staff of three urban foresters, and we've provided, on average, more than 600 technical assists per year. We've distributed over about $2 million worth of cost-share grants to nearly 500 cities and community projects. That's leveraged nearly $4 million in local expenditures. So it's a program. It's a relatively small program, but it has a long history and a pretty notable set of accomplishments given that size of that program. Going to our budget, a couple key policy or key drivers on the budget with this program that we are looking at right now. The first one is primarily is policy driven, and that has to do with the issue of forest fragmentation and development that we are seeing becoming a bigger and bigger issue. Some of the key drivers with this issue, of course, primarily is population growth, as well as a growing, which includes a growing urban population in Oregon. To give you a sort of perspective on the change we've seen over the course of the history of our department, like 100 years ago when our department was first formed, there were about 60 rural residents to every 40 urban residents. Today, we're approaching about 80 urban residents to every 20 rural residents. So we've seen a real shift in terms of the population of Oregon and where folks are living in the state. If I could go to the next slide. The fragmentation development issue is a nationwide issue. This is a map that's showing acres of forest land converted to developed land between 1982 and 1987. You can see it's predominantly occurring on the East Coast, but you do see the red spots showing up on the West Coast. Each red dot represents about 2,000 acres of newly developed land. We do our best estimates is that on a national scale, we're looking at about 50 million acres of forest land that will be converted over the next 50 years. Currently in Oregon, it's estimated we have about 1 million acres of Oregon forest lands, or roughly about 10% of our non-federal forest land base that exists within urban growth boundaries. And we do expect these million acres to be converted to development in the future. There's another approximately 2.5 million acres outside of urban growth boundaries where there's also the potential for conversion. And in total, this is about 30% of our non-federal forest land base that's at risk of either development or fragmentation due to intermixing of development. As you'll see here in the next presentation on our private forest program, you'll see that this has an impact across our department. It's not just an urban program piece. It's a private forest piece. It's a fire program piece where there are impacts. It's even a state forest program piece. If you remember, I mentioned Senate Bill 98 that was introduced in part to give us more tools to address one of the issues related to forest fragmentation development, and that is the risk of working forests moving out of forest production. In terms of our private forest piece, which again you'll hear more about, but a recent survey we did, we estimate about 20% of our workload is currently taken up by issues in these developed and developing areas. So it's something we're having to deal with already. We believe we can have probably new and improved and better tools to deal with, and it's part of the key drivers behind the budget for the Urban and Community Forestry Program. The second driver here, capacity-driven driver, is related to a federal decline in funding. We are seeing a decline in federal dollars that is going to result in a reduction of our urban forestry program from 3 FTE to 2 FTE. And in the POP that we have, POP 140, there are two parts to this POP. The first one is a restoration piece, essentially designed to make up for that anticipated loss of funding to maintain our current program. The second part of the POP, 140B, is an enhancement piece to help us start to address these forest, these fragmentation and development issues that we're seeing become increasing issues in Oregon. Some of the tangible benefits of these services that we would provide include dealing with protecting homes from wildfire in these interface areas, retaining healthy streams and other forest values in developed and developing areas, and also helping homeowners and commercial forest operators coexist as neighbors. I think I'll move on to section B, page 4.2, on the performance measure results. Our urban and community forest program, we have one performance measure, and that is around the percent of Oregon cities that are actively managing their urban and community forest resources. You can see since 2000, we've seen a steady increase in approaching our target with a little bit of a drop in 2005. We do anticipate that with our current staffing and funding, we can achieve that 50% target. With the prospect of losing those federal dollars and a reduction in our program staff, we don't believe we will be able to achieve that 50% target. We don't know at this point what, in fact, that would be, but we do believe we will. It'll be problematic and might lead to having to adjust that target for our performance measure. Let's see. Factors, I just want to point out a few of the factors affecting the results here. Just to give you some sort of tangible examples around what the services this program provides and sort of components that we consider to be signs of active management in urban and community forests. We help urban communities hire some developed forestry-trained professional staff, which would be city employees or private contractors, the formation of citizen advisory committees, develop tree ordinances, as well as inventory-based management plans so that urban communities have a good inventory and sense of their urban forests and are able to manage for them successfully. In terms of proposed performance measures, we do not have any new performance measures. It would be a continuation of the existing one. Moving on to page 4 or 5 under program priorities, you can see the total budget of both what I referred to as 140 Part A and Part B. It's the combination of those two is summarized there. In total, we would be looking at close to $2.5 million in total funds. About $241,000 of that would be derived from general funds. Oh. $240,000. Moving on to Section E, Policy Packages and Performance Measures, there you can see a general breakdown of the two parts to this POP. Again, 140A is the restoration piece to maintain our current service levels. 140B it would add capacity to our program to help us start to address this fragmentation and development issue. I want to talk a little bit more in the context of this fragmentation development issue and sort of what's behind the proposal to look at additional 7 FTEs. And if I could go to the next slide. This slide kind of depicts our department's current thinking and kind of an internal work group that we've put together to think about this issue and how best we as a department want to move forward in terms of best addressing this fragmentation and development issue. If you look back historically at the department, at the beginning when the department was formed, if you think about the primary challenges to healthy working forests, which is one of our key missions is maintaining healthy working forests, wildfire was the real driver. There was a real concern around wildfire being the biggest risk to healthy working forests. And in the beginning, we were formed around that notion. As we sort of got a handle on that challenge, we saw an evolution to then the deforestation being the primary challenge. And we acquired more tools to also deal with that challenge. And you can see in the timeline there that occurred in roughly the 1920s and let's say up to the 1970s. As we got to the 1960s, 1970s, we saw another shift in terms of the primary challenge. and that had to do with the notion of environmental awareness, environmental protection. This is the time where we saw the passage of the Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act. The Forest Practices Act was passed in 1971, the first of its kind. We added some additional tools to what the department uses and what it does to maintain healthy working forests. And what we think we're seeing right now is another key shift in terms of the primary challenges is in terms of when we think about maintaining healthy working forests. And a lot of signs of us approaching or even at a tipping point in many rural communities in Oregon in terms of the struggle to maintain these healthy working forests. And we've termed this fragmentation and development. Some of the key drivers you can see summarized up there include increasing land value, changing ownership interest, as well as ballot measure 37. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, population drive increases is an overriding driver that ties into all of those. Go to the next slide. Related to this shift in terms of the sort of keep the primary challenge towards maintaining healthy working forest is also a shift in terms of the stakeholders and interest groups that we are working with or need to look to working closely with in the future. And here under our environmental awareness paradigm, we dealt with what we term traditional forest industry companies, the Weyerhaeusers, the Willamettes, the Boise Cascades, traditional family forest landowners, as well as what's termed here BMP advocacy groups in terms of the environmental conservation side. As you'll hear more in the presentation on our private forest program, we've seen a shift here to where Weyerhaeuser is the only quote-unquote traditional forest industry company around, and now we have organizations that are called timber management organizations, real estate investment trusts, and there are some examples up there where they have a very different view in terms of how they manage their lands, a shorter time horizon in terms of realizing financial returns on those lands. We also see a new generation of family forest landowners coming online with the passage of lands to a younger generation. We see a growth in the residential forests. And finally, we see a shift in terms of the environmental and conservation organizations to perhaps looking more and working with forest conservation, what we call them here, organizations that are looking at this issue of fragmentation and development and seeing how we can work together to best address that and minimize the loss of working forests. If I go to the next slide, please. And this is just an example in terms of how ballot measure 37 sort of plays into this issue. This is a map of Washington County and the claims, ballot measure 37 claims in that county. On the west side of that map is predominantly forest lands, forest landowners that have filed those claims. Now, it's of course, at this point, we don't know what percentage of those claims are going to end up in being realized and conversion occurring, but you can see sort of the risk that's out there in terms of the fragmentation piece, just looking at ballot measure 37 itself and not necessarily looking at those other drivers that I mentioned earlier. Go to that next slide, I think that's it. Just to sort of close on this topic, this is, of course, is a figure you've been helped yesterday for a while. We've got under the Forestry Program for Oregon, which again is the Board of Forestry's sort of strategic vision for forest lands in Oregon. It's this residential value emphasis forests that this program is primarily looking at. And the enhancement package under 140B of the POP would look at adding our capacity to try to deal more effectively with where we see the risk of wood production emphasis forests moving out of that into residential value emphasis, or even the risk of forests moving out of forest land use entirely. These seven positions would at least be a start. I mean, as you can see, the magnitude of this problem, you might say, well, seven positions is not a whole lot to deal with this, but we believe it would give us a start to try and look at different tools and see how we can work differently in these developing areas to help better address these risks that are out there and these concerns. I think finally, the last section here of our budget, section F, the summary of proposed legislation. The department does not have any introduced legislation. However, there is one piece of legislation that has come up recently here, and it's summarized there. that has to do with creating a task force on Oregon Strategic Forest Reserve and is would direct a task force to study using non-rural public land for growing trees. And with that, I think I'll stop. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
Representative Burley.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Two questions. I'm a little confused. And if neither POP 148 or 140B were to be enacted, would there be no funding at all for this urban forestry program? Is that correct?
They have a small amount in their case, but I think it would be one condition.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, it would reduce our staff in terms of on the ground. It would reduce our urban forestry staff by half-time position. So we'd have to reduce one of our three folks from a full-time to a half-time.
So you'd be left with 2.5 FTE.
Well, I believe we'd be left with two. I believe that's correct.
Yeah. Chair Devlin, I think we're already at about 2.5 FTEs. And we'd take another half out. And essentially, without any of the POPs, all we've got to count on is federal funds, which is all the program has had for several years, and those are going down as well. So
leaves them with a very small budget.
Right. Okay. In the little summary that we were provided, it says that based on what the federal government is requiring, the states would need to allocate at least $400,000 per biennium to be eligible for federal funds. Without the POPs, we wouldn't meet that level. Okay. And then one last question. If the Forest Legacy Bill were to pass that expands the authority outside the urban growth boundary, would that program be funded and staffed out of this urban forestry package?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, I currently that program is staffed through our private forest program. Of course, depending on how our budget ends up this biennium, we're looking at a couple we're looking at funding issues with our private forest program as well as this program. It may or may not continue to rest with that program. There is the potential for it to be addressed partly through this program, but currently we do address that through our private forest program.
Thank you.
Previously, this committee has considered the budget for the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and during that presentation, they basically went through some statistics, which I think would be available to anyone. They're part of the Oregon benchmarks, which basically would look at some of these issues a little bit differently and give you entirely different conclusions. One of them is, I believe, that their data just looking, and they're looking outside urban growth boundaries, would look at very little actual reduction in forest lands outside urban growth boundaries over the last 30 years. But that doesn't indicate anything about the quality of those forest lands, just simply in terms of raw number of acres of forest lands. But the benchmark itself doesn't even speak to forests inside urban growth boundaries.
Chair Devlin, the current land use law has been pretty effective at slowing conversion. I don't believe that really speaks to the future, and there has been a significant changeover in ownership in forest land that started a few years ago on the east side and has continued now on the west side. Every time there is a large changeover in ownership like that, there's a certain percent that gets spun off into higher and better use, which is residential type development. And as you say, the quality also, there's some of those lands that were we would say have moved out of working forest on the east side, for example, are not significant contributors to the timber supply anymore because they've been over-harvested and are just sitting there. A lot of those have been bought by private individuals and taken out of the public recreation opportunity environment. And there is a fairly telling change that's taking place right now. And ballot measure 37, you know, isn't going to drive that really as much as the ability for and desire for people to invest in private forest land and want to own it in order to make a living at it. That's really driving that change more than anything, particularly on the east side where the infrastructure and milling capacity has gone down. It means that private landowners who used to haul 50 miles to a sawmill now haul 300 miles to a sawmill. It makes their timber less valuable, makes it more likely that they're going to look at other uses for their land. And those are the kind of things that are driving this as much as anything.
Well, when you showed your slide of fragmentation, particularly in the east, not east, eastern Oregon, east, it reminded me that even though they've been effective to some degree, given the circumstances they haven't been as effective as Oregon land use policies. But some of those states have sort of major land trust organizations that their sole purpose is to either preserve agricultural or forest lands or both. But I just think it's just kind of interesting to me the way different agencies look at these numbers. In fact, another number that they would give you, and I'm sure Representative Girard has heard this.
I'm just waiting for you to
yes.
drop the shoe.
Yes, that while the shift in Oregon in terms of population, rural and urban, has been a major shift, the number of residences being located in resource lands that are not resource related has skyrocketed. In fact, I can remember a land use discussion we had a few sessions ago that didn't go very far about potentially limiting the number of dwellings that could be located, in a sense, directly adjacent to actively managed forests.
It's a really good issue, and it's really why we've put this 140B pop in our budget. It's because we get drawn into that situation regularly with people who aren't necessarily happy with they're either not happy that a land's being converted to a resident and they want us to come in and apply the Forest Practices Act to stop it. Or they've already got a residence there and they're not happy about the forest practices that are taking place next door to them, and they want us to come in and apply the Forest Practices Act to stop it. And as Jim said, we spend an inordinate amount of time in that area, particularly relative to the amount of harvest tax that's collected in those areas. I mean, it's certainly not paying its way right now, how we have to deal with that. One issue on the trust associations weighing in and buying land, was reading an article yesterday. I think just in the last few years in the southeastern part of the country, there's been 10 million acres change hands, and trusts have ended up purchasing 250,000 of those. So in scale, they're still not able to make a big difference. The big difference is, you know, at a system-wide basis where people want to own and invest in forest land and keep it that way. That's the best way to deal with the issue.
Representative Girard, since you're in meetings on a daily basis on this, did you want to chime in at all?
Not at this time.
Any additional questions or comments? One final question. In terms of the requirement that Representative Burley pointed out about continued state support, if you did not have continued state support, how soon before you would lose the right for federal funds or lose the ability to receive them?
Chair Devlin, the Forest Service has just changed the allocation methodology for that. And I'm not sure, does it kick in this federal fiscal year?
It does, but the matching requirement isn't there yet.
So it'll be probably another year or two before the matching requirement kicks in. They just made the change to the allocation formula this year, so they're giving people some transition time to go there.
Anything additional? Okay. I guess we're on to private for us.
Sounds good.
Morning, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester in charge of the private forest program. A number of the issues were discussed with the urban and community forest, but I'm going to provide some more detail on some of them. This graphic's been used a number of times. Just some background. In terms of our regulatory program, the Forest Practices Act, it applies regardless of zoning or taxation. So it does apply within urban growth boundaries unless a city government has adopted regulations specific to forest practices, and we don't regulate within that particular area. Otherwise, we do regulate it within urban growth boundaries. And beyond that, the Forest Practice Act applies within rural residential zones or any other zone that may occur in the state. The private forest programs where a lot of things get integrated. With regard to the discussion about the increase in residential forests, there's no doubt that's occurring. One other phenomenon that we see in terms of the wood production forests, as they get bifurcated in terms of highest and best use, that sometimes goes to residential use. It sometimes goes to the nature emphasis forest as well, and we're seeing some of that, and sometimes it goes to the multi-use forest as well. So there's really kind of a breakup of the working forest into three different pathways, depending upon whether a conservancy group pursues it or some eco-trust type group pursues it or a residential buyer pursues it. Kind of the classic example, the change in this, there's a parcel in eastern Oregon that was industrial land that has been purchased, about 5,000 acres, by a Microsoft millionaire for his satellite telescope to look for aliens, and that's why he's bought his 5,000 acres to have solitude to do that. So we're seeing a real shift in interest in
that's in my district.
That's in his district.
That's space aliens, not Klamath County aliens. Okay. Next slide. I think it's always important to talk about things what I'm most proud about, and again, we're the program that often integrates things. We have a host of stewardship foresters that are out there doing a number of tasks trying to help private landowners accomplish a number of goals in support of the state's environmental, economic, and social needs. This particular map shows work that we put together in the John Day Canyon City area, and it began about 2000. We pursued two National Fire Program grants, and those were awarded, and we created the Canyon Creek Vegetative Management and Strawberry Vegetative Management areas, which are the kind of the green dots up there, the private land portions. We started in 2001 working with the Forest Service and BLM to some degree, encourage them to treat their fuels around those private land parcels to make sure that it adds value to what's being undone on those private lands in terms of the fuel treatments. Those particular federal areas were identified as the highest priority in the Community Wildfire Protection Plan. The federal land projects got underway along with the private land projects in between 2003 and 2004. We secured additional funding through the Bark Beetle Mitigation Grant, got some Western State Forest Managers grants in 2006, and in combination, that area of federal and private lands was treated. About 1,600 acres of private lands and 200 homes were within that private land areas. And again, beetle treatments, fire treatments look much the same. They're basically trying to thin the forest, make it in a healthy, fire-safe condition. And that's the kind of work that we do, leveraging a whole host of funds, working with a range of landowners to make a comprehensive effort in terms of improving forest conditions. Another thing I'm really proud about and kind of things we do is remove bureaucratic barriers. And I always like picking on my federal partners because we enjoy them so much. We often call them aliens as well. But back in the early 2000s, the state forester tells me not to make jokes, but I can't help myself. Back in the early 2000s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers reinterpreted their regulations to require a Clean Water Act fill and removal permit for placement of large woody debris for stream restoration projects. As a result of that, particularly where fish were listed, which is most of Oregon, that meant for people to get a permit from the feds, they had to go through consultation with the federal services. There were some efforts they made to streamline that, but as a result of the additional bureaucracy, the efforts that people were willing to undertake in terms of stream restoration declined dramatically. We worked with the Corps on this topic, and we eventually got them to reinterpret their reinterpretation and basically reach a conclusion that forest operations are silviculturally exempt from the Clean Water Act, and therefore things that are done as part of a forest operation don't need the permit. The Board of Forestry adopted a rule to make a statement to that regard, and now forest landowners are able to go forward under our normal processes rather than have to go through federal processes. And if I would have believed we'd be successful there, I would have been willing to bet against myself. That was a tremendous amount of work to get that done. And that's the kind of things the program did. Now, why is this important? Well, private land certainly right now contribute the lion's share by a huge margin of the timber harvest in the state. Obviously, the industrial lands, in terms of proportion of their ownership, are a huge contributor. The non-industrial private land or the family forest lands, which are on the right-hand bar there, contribute proportionately to their ownership. And maintaining that contribution is incredibly important in terms of the forest economy. Marvin had talked about the relative contributions of the forest sector to the state of Oregon's economy. Again, in terms of total contributions, it's near 11% of the traded sector employment and economy. That's huge in terms of our tax base and income. In addition to the basic forest sector, Oregon really is the center of the universe when it comes to forestry, in terms of our planet. And that's really true. I mean, people look to Oregon for a number of things. As a result of our role, we're kind of the center of some other businesses that are related to, like the heavy lift helicopter industry, those sorts of things, are co-located. So, again, large contribution economically. This is kind of, and Jim Paul alluded to the tipping point we're at. What I've done is for each ownership of the four major owners of federal, state, industrial, and family forest, we've listed by what they have the potential to harvest and what they've got planned and what's actual. So for federal lands, their potential harvest is over 3 billion board feet. Their plan is about 1 billion board feet, and their actual is around 400 million. It varies. Some years it's actually been low below the state harvest. Again, the state ownership, very small in proportion, but provides about the same level of harvest as the federal, and again, they're harvesting at the planned level. Industrial, basically growth and harvest are about the same. They have some potential to increase their harvest through more intensive management, but it's relatively limited. The family forest land ownership, about 15-16% of the total. Right now, they're about half of what they could produce. And again, looking at this whole picture, we have the opportunity, if we retain the forest land base and its productivity, to very easily increase the contributions to Oregon's economy by 17,000 jobs and support the market infrastructure that comes with that, plus improve other related industries like the heavy lift helicopter. Or we have the choice of tipping the forest land base towards less production and potentially losing those jobs or losing the jobs we're at now. Truly think we're at a tipping point. And just to put some context, the nation's timber supply, about 40% of it, wood supply, is coming from our import, mainly from Canada, but increasingly from other countries. So basically, we're exporting jobs with some of the choices we made around some of our policies.
Yes.
I know the federal forest is down a huge amount. Do you folks have any comparison, say, like, if we were even half of what the federal forest
timber harvest we used to have, how would that affect the economy? Do you have any facts and figures on that? I mean, how would it affect our budget process?
Basically, for every billion board feet increase, you get 17,000 direct jobs. So going from, if they got to the billion, that's about 70% of 17,000. Susie, do the math. But going from 1 billion to 2 billion would be about 17,000 additional direct jobs. So there's some real potential gain in this sector. And again, how we choose to invest in that will make a huge difference in our both our general economy and our rural economy.
For the state forests, I would assume that a large portion of that 295 is Tillamook, right?
Tillamook Clatsop, yes, that's correct.
Tillamook Clatsop.
Yeah. This is a point there. You know, when people look at the forest, and the Oregon Forest Resource Institute did a study looking at growth versus mortality, and at least for the state forest, there's an important need at this point in time to accumulate volume because of the past management history of those lands. On the federal lands, we're accumulating volume in mortality and then burning it. And so there's a subtle but important difference of how the outcomes of those two lands are occurring. If you go ahead. State Forester Brown discussed the Eastern Oregon situation, and again, I think we're really at a crisis in Eastern Oregon. The ability of people to make money on their forest lands in terms of timber production has declined dramatically. There's now just 18 mills left. We expect that to be reduced by at least three over the next 5 years. Again, hauling distance makes a huge difference in our ability to manage those lands. Another subtle point about Eastern Oregon, while 57% of Oregon's ownership is federal, in Eastern Oregon it's actually close to 70%. So proportionally, Eastern Oregon has more federal land. Unlike Western Oregon, where the federal lands tend to be less productive than the private lands, the federal lands tend to be more productive than the private lands. So proportionately, they are more productive than even their ownership percentage would indicate. So without them contributing substantially, they're in real trouble in Eastern Oregon in terms of sustaining their infrastructure. In terms of family forest landowners, again, they've got a huge potential to increase their contribution. They manage their lands for a range of interests. They oftentimes manage them kind of in the multi-resource opportunity. There's been a steady growth in the number of family forest landowners. And just to be kind of a little sense of what family forest landowners are, basically these are the owners that by location, they're either in a forest zone or by choice they're in some sort of a forest land tax program. And again, outside of that context, there are a whole host of residential forest owners in the many thousands that really, like in rural residential zones, that we also have an interest in helping. But in terms of the family forest landowners, they're steadily increasing population. Again, we've seen about 150% increase over the course of the last 30 years. We're likely to see a fairly large increase in this larger ownership as the highest and best use conversions occur. In terms of the industrial ownerships. Go ahead and skip the next four. This gets to the national context that Jim Paul talked about. Go to 13. There is a trend from working forests to residential forests. And again, that's nothing new, but next slide. What really is driving this, though, is basically the value of trees, particularly in Eastern Oregon, but not just in Eastern Oregon, is really getting to be the lesser compared to the value of the land for residential uses. And go ahead. These next data come from Forest Capital, LLC, the company that purchased the Boise lands in Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon. And they basically, from the REIT perspective, they go through and analyze their ownership. And they bought Boise Cascade, the lands, and they've looked at it in terms of a per-acre cost, and they make the question, okay, if we resell that land for the highest and best use, what might we get for it? And they've gone through nationally their ownerships and analyzed what's the real estate versus the timber value. It's interesting, Idaho, and you can see the behavior of the large companies there, the real estate values are 6.5 times the timber values, and that land's really developing. But even in Oregon, northeast Oregon, real estate values 2.75 times the timber values. And even in western Oregon, where I thought we'd be long-term off from seeing this occurring, The real estate values now reach the point where we are seeing people behave and break off lands in forest zones, and you can sell on in a forest zone, you automatically get a dwelling if you have 160 acres, and people are willing to buy 160 acres in a forest zone to get a dwelling now. And we're certainly seeing that in eastern Oregon. In terms of another trend, there's a changing interest and expertise of family forest landowners. I'll have to tell a little bit of a humorous around this, because when I first started in forestry 30 years ago, this was a very similar statistic, in that half the family forest landowners were old. Most of them apparently have survived because they've gotten older, which says a lot about their constitution. But they are going through this generational change now, and actually there have been some studies on it where the new generation views the forest land very differently, basically views it as an asset to generate cash from as opposed to manage for timberland values. The expertise is greatly different, and I get a chuckle. You ask people in Central Oregon about those juniper forests, and most of them think they're natural as opposed to something that's occurred due to fire suppression and grazing practices. But, again, perspectives are different about what's natural with these folks. So the behaviors are relatively fascinating. This is the kind of things we get into. This is actually farmland. You can't see it very well, but there's a pile of firewood right there. You can see the cut off large woody debris there. They felt they needed to go into the stream and remove the wood for firewood. That's a lot of what we get into. Some people will call up and make a complaint about logging going on in the stream. And actually, this is non-regulated by the Forest Practice Act, private use firewood cutting. There isn't a law that prevents removal of wood for non-forest operations. But they really don't understand very well the consequences of their action. And we see lots of educational problems that come from these sorts of new ownerships. In terms of industrial owners, this was alluded to, but 27% of Oregon's industrial lands are now owned by a TIMO or a REIT. And 40% of the Oregon's forest lands have changed ownerships or been converted to one of these new types of structures in the past decade. The remaining 60% of the industrial lands tend to be family-owned corporations like Roseburg Forest Products, Stimson Lumber Company. And they're likely to stay to be integrated, but they're not a corporate-type firm in terms of on the stock market or publicly shared.
Yes, Representative Farrar has a question.
Just a comment, because there is so much similarity between what is happening to agriculture and what is happening to timber, that it's a driving force behind Measure 37, in that if we have layered our land use with so many restrictions that people cannot make a profit any longer by managing that land, so therefore they look to selling it. And you have hit part of what Measure 37 was all about right on the head this morning.
Okay.
No, that is a good point. As we said, the driver isn't so much ballot measure 37 as it is the willingness of people to own and invest in forest land. That's
regulatory cost. A whole host of things go with that.
And maybe it's going to come up later in your presentation, but given the dynamics you just described in the slide previously that showed that you're making more land off selling the land than the timber harvest, I don't know what the message is in that. Is the message that people are investing in this land, selling the timber, and then selling the land to achieve greater profit as opposed to holding it within families like maybe they used to do?
Senator Vakian, that's correct. And again, they're usually selling it to a landowner that's very disconnected from the land, has very little knowledge about how to manage forest health, but is really out there for residential values. And their perspective about how to hold that land and maintain its forest health is often pretty naive at best.
And of the comments regarding Measure 37, I don't get any impression that Measure 30 that there is some kind of local regulation or Measure 37 is in some way precluding that from happening.
Senator Vakin, you're correct. It's not precluding from happening, but it's not the major driver either. I consider Measure 37 really a symptom as opposed to the disease itself, and I think Representative Girard described the disease pretty well. The value that people can derive from their forest land for forest uses has reached the point that they see higher value in marketing it for other uses, whether it's residential, continuing forest cover, or some other use directly. And again, part of the theory that we can address this with is try and add value to the forest use so people will be able to retain that forest land and get economic value out of this adequate to sustain the forest over the longer term. And Chair Devlin talked about the benchmark that Department of Land Conservation Development used. Actually, we share that indicator or benchmark of the amount of federal land still preserved for federal use. We're actually the ones that gather those data. We put out a periodic report, and actually we have a network of plots all around the state called the FIA plots, where we can look at both actual conversion and densification of dwellings over time, and we have those data, and what if this, and this shows the progress of those data over time. And it's very true. Go ahead. The land use program has been very, very effective in Oregon, and actually in the context of comparing us nationally, it's fair to say Oregon has done probably the best job of retaining forest land for forest uses through the land use program up until recently. And it's fair to say, I would argue, that the land use program is no longer likely to predict the outcomes of forest conversion because of these changes we've talked about. Go ahead.
Another question.
I'm not sure what you mean. You've said it several times when you say retain forest land for forest purposes. I'm not sure what forest purposes means anymore, given the discussion we're having.
Forest purposes include a whole host of things, from timber values to fish and wildlife habitat, recreation, water quality. Half the state's water comes off of forest lands. So that's kind of the broad array of ecosystem services of which timber is one of. And again, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but as you get into residential uses, the ability of those lands as they get developed and fragmented to provide those uses goes down tremendously. Again, in terms of wildlife habitat, the South Hills of Salem, as fragmented as they are, don't provide for nearly the quality of wildlife habitat that more intact forest land would provide, nor are they probably just good at water quality.
And if you get, as you move in away from actively managed land, there's a diminishing value for across other things like water quality and wildlife as well, because things like insect disease, overstocking, forest health, wildfire risk start to kick in that aren't dealt with when there's not active management on those properties. And so in the end, you end up losing across the whole set of values by and large.
Also, if you have a huge fire, the carbon dioxide that's emitted, probably one of the fires, the B&B fire, one of them was six times the amount of carbon dioxide in a three-week period than the whole entire state of Oregon produced in 1 year. Is that, am I right on that?
It's probably close. Fundamentally, forests oxidize eventually. It's a question of timing and total amount, and very intensive wildfires oxidize more than would occur if you had a less intense wildfire. Also, that fire was of a size that was way outside the norm of what you'd expect for the natural fire regime. So it had both intensity and size that was unusual about it. That's typical as you modify the fuels, is that they become abnormal. You've seen this map of Washington County. Go ahead, Jill, next one. This really shows the timber harvest in Washington County. And it's kind of interesting because in this particular county, the non-industrial private lands actually are a fairly large component of the county ownership, but yet contributes a relatively small portion of the harvest. This contracts actually quite differently to some other counties similarly situated, which we'll look at next, Jill. And this is Clackamas County. Again, Measure 37 claims that really changes the landscape of Clackamas County. Next. But yet, in Clackamas County, the non-industrial privates contribute fairly significant to the timber harvest. And their social and economic reasons for that, that retain some of the contributions of those lands that are pretty significant. But then the real fear, next slide, these are data from Oregon, but they're very consistent across the country. As building density goes up in forest areas, and this is showing the behaviors of forest industry lands that are adjacent and the family forest lands that are adjacent, but as density goes up, as you get towards about 40 dwellings per square mile, the likelihood of people investing in intensive forest management gets down to zero. And again, this represents pre-commercial thinning, but that pattern plays out for all sorts of treatments. And there's a whole host of reasons for that, but we're on the trajectory, at least for Washington and Clackamas County, which from forest lands perspective are very, very productive forest lands, of seeing much less investment in those kind of lands.
Okay, again, when you say, when you're talking about forest management, what you're talking about is, if I'm hearing right, is instead of managing the forest, meaning you keep it what we would think of as a traditional forest land, even if you're harvesting and replanting or something, and you're either you're clearing it in order to develop. Is that what you're talking about?
You get a mix of that. In some cases, you get the clearing to develop like this, where you lose, if you don't do the conversion well, the green infrastructure, which we're very concerned about maintaining forest streams, water quality. But in some cases, it's just a matter of your ability. It's not being converted. The forest land stays the same, but it's got enough dwellings scattered around in the forest cover that the landowners that do want to manage have enough conflicts they choose not to. And so, again, the simple example we use is coming up here in terms of herbicide application. As you get enough people living out there adjacent to the forest lands, they have problems with herbicide and they start raising concern. Go ahead, Jill. This is an example of a current issue. And again, one of the interesting ironies of our behaviors, Oregon did adopt right to farm and forest laws in the early 90s. And actually, when you move out in a forest zone, even an ag zone, people are supposed to sign as a condition of getting a dwelling that they're not going to bring action against approved farm and forest practices. But once they get out there, their behaviors change. We tend to forget that commitment. But these folks are very concerned about herbicide application, and they've been coming into some meetings at the Department of Forestry raising these issues. They certainly provide a number of complaints. We got a complaint last week from a person involved in this. The spray operation was 2 miles away, but yet the concern was that she was sick and her pets were sick, which then started an investigation and a complaint to the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, and that takes a lot of our time and energy to deal with this sort of issue. Again, they very strongly believe in these concerns, but it's quite a challenge for us to manage them.
When you're looking at your Clackamas County slide that you had previous to this, let's see. Obviously, everything to the much of what's to the far right there is all federal forest lands, or large
federal
portion of it. And then, even though you've got those Measure 37 claims there, actually, Clackamas County has a vast amount of land outside the urban growth boundary that's exception lands.
That's correct.
That's already quite parcelized, actually. So,
and the way this shows up is the federal lands are in this color. This is the forest zone is the darker green.
Yeah.
The ag forest zones are the light green, and the farm zones are the lighter green. The white, I believe, are exception urban growth boundaries, so it does show up there. But these are some industrial ownerships. In fact, we had a ballot measure 37 claim we denied on this particular piece that I can't remember how it was, like 350 acres for a subdivision of multiple.
I just wonder, in a sense, how some of this is even theoretically prevented, because now we're getting off a little bit in policy here, but I've had this discussion with one of the co-chairs who happens to be from Canby. And obviously, at one time, he might still believe that, but at one time, Canby was a rural community.
But it actually, for all practical purposes, it is so close to the metropolitan area that it's become a bedroom community of the metropolitan area, and people can afford to go out there and buy 20 acres or 10 acres just simply because they want a home out in the country, not because they want to manage it for any natural resource purpose. So I don't know how you prevent that from happening around any large metropolitan area. If people have the resources to buy the land, and if the land becomes so valuable...
Chair Devlin, that really is the purpose of our policy option package 140B, I think it is. If our notion is that if we could locate individuals in different developing communities like that, and Klamath Falls, Eugene, North Coast, around Portland, Bend, those places, and get those folks embedded in the communities and start to work not on stopping that trend, because I think you're right, it's not going to stop, but how can we interject some resource management knowledge into that creates a better result for everybody, that deals with, well, there still are water quality, fish habitat values that are of concern. There's still a wildlife habitat values, aesthetic concerns. There's still some potential to generate forest products, even on a small 20-acre tract. And can we develop a programmatic approach that really places us into those situations and create something better for everybody? That's really the whole notion of that policy option package.
Yeah, I started it. Representative Burley and Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back a couple of slides, please? First, just in general, I, of course, from the east side, I don't deal quite as much with these small parcels as your example around Canby, but to me, the big issue is the large blocks of forest land right now. And as Ted pointed out, with the changes in the forest industry organization, with Weyerhaeuser really being the only remaining true industrial forest landowner, vis-a-vis the others are now REITs and TMOs and those types of organizations. My concern is when you're looking at 30 to 90 to 100,000 acre blocks of timberland and those getting parceled up and developed into 240 with a home, that to me is problematic, and we need to deal with that. Question though, Ted, here with Clackamas County, does that county own some timberland themselves as Hood River and some other counties do? I believe Clackamas has some county timberland, don't they?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, I don't know. Hood River, Douglas, and Coos are the ones I'm aware of. And Clackamas County, I believe, has a demonstration forest, about 2,000 acres. Okay, so you have a little bit.
So then in your statistics, when you show industrial forest land and non-industrial private forest land, for these counties that have county timberland, where would they fall in that category? Would they be considered industrial or non-industrial?
They'd be considered industrial if they behave that way.
Okay.
Yeah. And I guess to the point here, really the policy choice is this is some of the most productive forest land in the world. And on a 20 to 40 acre basis, ultimately what we decide and help these people accomplish with regard to forest values, whether it's wildlife or timber or other things, has a huge chance to be a positive contribution. If we don't sustain that, the tipping point's going to occur. We're going to see those jobs disappear. We're going to see the infrastructure disappear. So there's tax policy. There's other things that go on in these arenas that we've got to think about. And, again, when you plop on this particular proposal here, I forget total number of dwellings, but it was a lot on 300 and so acres. Putting that kind of subdivision in industrial forest land location, it's going to have a huge impact. I mean, those industrial landowners are not going to want to spray, or they're going to manage their lands differently. The cost of management goes way up, so it creates some real challenges. Okay, go ahead. 27. You've heard this on the fire side. Very clearly, as dwelling densities go up, the probability of a fire start goes up, and the cost of fire suppression goes up. These are actually data from the Sisters unit in Eastern Oregon, but that pattern is repeated in our other study areas. And again, how we manage that is going to be really, really important, and the private forest program helps people deal with that.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I think I got skipped, but I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. No, I think you did, actually.
And it was just relevant to what you were talking about before, in that the Measure 37 committee has spent a lot of time discussing exactly what we're getting to this morning here. And there are some alternatives. Clustering at the nearest point near a UGB to keep that growth in the right spot. Something that we're going to recommend to the Big Look Committee is something called TDRs, which is transferable development rights, which would allow you to trade high-value farmland or forest land on this side of the mountains to anywhere else within the state where those restrictions did not apply. And finally, there's quite a discussion going on between 2 and 5 acres as far as a minimum maximum. If you have 5 acres as a minimum, does that help create a more manageable? In other words, I'll leave some trees up, but if you make everybody cluster on 1 acre, then they might take every tree down. So it's quite an interesting discussion, and unfortunately, we don't have any of the answers yet, but at least those are some of the possible solutions that might go along with this. And at least we're thinking and talking about it. So,
Chair
Thank
Devlin,
you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Girard, I mean, those points are well taken, and indeed, as you look at the fire issue, while risk goes up with dwelling densities, with the right management of those dwellings, you can reduce the hazard by having better fire departments because more pack space, those sorts of things, better access. So it's confounding in some of the outcomes. The private forest program does deal with public safety in terms of landslides, and this is a pretty emotional issue for our department for a number of reasons. This is where the institutional memory of Oregonians, our new citizens, really plays a role. This represents the winter storm we had 2 years ago on New Year's Day, Eve Day, and a bunch of flooding around Oregon. One of the persons we talked to down in this area said, gee whiz, I've lived here 5 years, it's never done this before. This is BLM ownership, never been harvested. Debris torrent came out of here, came down, crossed the road, went into this person's home, and you know, that was kind of scary enough. But as we were visiting the site, you can see the deposited material here, and this is the building permit for the person that's excavating the newly deposited material and building their home site on it. That's not a very good choice. Part of the reason why this is occurring, when Senate Bill 12 was adopted 8 years ago now, there was supposed to be a process to create further review area maps that would help counties identify these areas and prevent people from locating homes there. That process has never been completed. Now, Dogami had a policy option package for LIDAR to help do some of that mapping. We are seeing lots of new homes. I'm not making a pitch for that at all. Just as a sidebar, we are trying to cooperate with the forest sector to actually put together a cooperative to acquire LIDAR on a private initiative with the department. So, but what LIDAR does is allow us to very correctly identify the positive positives and avoid the false positives and the false negatives. We are seeing a lot of these kind of homes going in right now. And it reflects people's inexperience living out in the woods. We can take you a tour down along the Umpqua River that you would be pretty flabbergasted about people's behaviors. But it's very traumatic for our folks to talk to these people and say, do you realize what you're doing? It affects their property values. It's even more traumatic when people get hurt or killed. So landslides will occur. Again, unharvested land here. and buy a person building a home there, by rule, that ownership will then impair management of this parcel until that further review area process is in place. In terms of...
Yes, we have a question here. Senator Vaughn.
What did you mean by your department getting LIDAR on a private initiative?
Well, Chair Dillon, Senator Vaughn, oftentimes when we get resources in the forest sector, we'll put together cooperatives, whether it's a research cooperative or an aerial photo cooperative, to try and our seed cooperative, where we try and pool our resources and make an investment in the technology or the product. And, again... LIDAR has application for all sorts of stuff in terms of inventorying vegetation. It actually, if you do it at a quality that's well enough, you can inventory large woody debris and stream channels and channel form and do all sorts of stuff with it. Typically, the map you saw there is a typical USGS quad map. We develop digital elevation models off of it. They're very...
We know what it is. I'm curious if you've got some type of a pilot program going that's going to be funded by private corporations to use LIDAR.
We are exploring that right now.
And I would think, actually, presuming that we can get the portion that's on the sort of short list of ad-backs, that would be something that GAMI would want to explore, because they actually, after the newspaper articles that occurred just about the time that... we were discussing their budget, they've had a lot of inquiries from both public and private entities wanting to do additional work, which they would help fund. So
it's incredible technology.
And I mean, I think obviously here, as you know, in the technology, it would allow you to see what the actual characteristics of the land are underneath the forest, basically.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, it's a great technology. My point, which I've harped on before, is just that if it's a great technology and the state needs to use it, then the state ought to be paying for it. And we shouldn't be forcing our state agencies to go out scrounge for corporate dollars to do something to accomplish their mission. And I guess I'm very glad the technology is there. I know the budget is tight. But once again, I just am greatly concerned that we're undercutting our agency's ability to do their job.
Chair Devlin, Senator Vaughn, we have become scroungers in the last 4 years in any number of ways, which we can talk about later. But we have leveraged a whole host of resources through contributions or these kind of cooperatives that make our job better, but it's very challenging to sustain those efforts, and that's been a real, real difficulty.
The comment, Mr. Chair, is not meant as a criticism of this committee, but more just a more general sense of our revenue stream in this state and how we're not able to do the things that we need to be doing.
In one of the questions we've had is really what are the things forest lands do that we're trying to help manage them for, and there's a range of services. And again, these include clean water. In fact, if you look at the State of the Environment report, it's the state's best water quality comes off forest lands. 50% of Oregon's drinking water comes off forest lands. Also, there's some opportunity in terms of carbon sequestration, and again, the bulk of Oregon's biodiversity is on forest lands.
Yes.
Just quickly on that topic, has the department been involved in the governor's efforts on the cap and trade for carbon emissions, because forest lands can play a role in that and should play a role in that? There's a lot of research and studies and reports that address that question, so I'm curious to what extent has the department been involved in that discussion.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, we have a staff person that's been leading a range of those efforts with the governor's office. The big bulk of the effort's been on biomass, bioenergy, as opposed to carbon caps and trades.
We've got the Forest Resource Trust.
We do have the Forest Resource Trust, which provides a actual mechanism where we've got dollars from the Klamath Cogen project as a carbon mitigation fund for afforestation that we have cost share. We're running into some problems, and we're working with Division of State Lands to look at what sort of market we might be able to get. But the struggle, I guess, is a whole host of issues around the baseline of forests and how you capture something above and beyond that, and certain perspectives about if you're doing something from a regulatory or a management plan standpoint anyway, why should you then get credit for things? So we're running into some policy issues on that topic. If you'd like, I could send you some more information on that. It would be, I think, useful to you. In terms of fish and wildlife impacts, in terms of the land fragmentation and conversion, is you get a whole host of impacts. These are often not thought about very much, but they're really important, and we deal with them all the time in terms of giving people advice about how to avoid these impacts. There's just loss of habitat generally, and oftentimes it can be loss of habitat function as well through fragmentation. Invasive species is a huge issue. In the earlier picture of the cleared land there, there's a bunch of Scotch broom in the picture. It's amazing how many people think Scotch broom and blackberry are native plants, but they're not. But even more importantly, infrastructure conflicts. And this is a large wood jam, very important for fish. We design our structures on forest lands to hopefully pass that material to allow it to function. Basically, wood moves through the system over time and space. But generally, as people develop residential uses, they tend to not want to allow the dynamic process to occur. And after the flood this winter, we got into an issue of a complaint about a person removing a jam very similar like that on the Sandy River with a helicopter. It was not a forest operation in terms of the commercial removal. It was cut up for private firewood use, but it was to protect a home. And again, that goes on all the time. But those are the kind of complaint issues we get engaged in.
Okay. Chair Devlin, it's almost the witching hour here. I don't know if you want us to go on or not. But
Well, maybe we'll see if we have any questions here, and we'll just stop in a couple of minutes. Yes, Representative Burley.
I do have a couple questions, but I'm not sure if this would be the best time to touch on them. One has to do with the watershed research cooperatives that the department's engaged in, and also the sudden oak death funding. But I would defer, Mr. Chair, if that's something that they're going to touch on, I'll just defer those questions.
We'll be prepared for those tomorrow.
You know, I think as we're closing today, just a comment that I would have, and it's not trying to testify here for Representative Garrard for his 30s. I have a family member that lives in an area, and I believe that the underlying landowner outside that area is Weyerhaeuser. And there's small tracts of land in that area that are private. They've been private for, I don't know what, 50 years, 40 years. Most of the people that live in there in that area, they're relatively modest homes. Most of them were connected to the forest industry before. Some of them still are. They have harvested large portions of tracts in that area, some within probably 100 yards, 150, 200 yards. I don't think one of those people would object. I mean, but if they ever sell and those modest homes are torn down and you know, $500,000 houses are put in, I'm pretty sure that those people would object to any of those practices, or a large portion of them would.
Chair Devlin, that is our experience.
Yes.
We spend a lot of time on it.
Yeah.
So, okay. Any additional comments? Well, we are adjourned for today, and we'll be back tomorrow.